Folks, Field of Greens is the healthiest thing I do every day, and I want you on this journey with me. Why? It's literally one scoop a day. It tastes great. I love the fruit flavors particularly, and it's completely improved my life and my health. This is nutrition the way nature intended. When I began taking a hard look at why I wasn't feeling good and why I felt unhealthy, why I was gaining weight, why I was losing energy, it wasn't just because I had hit my 50s. No, it was because I wasn't getting the right amount of fruit and vegetables in my diet. And listen, I'm just too busy to go to the store, clean up the vegetables, cook vegetable dinners, and make sure I hit the fruit. A Field of Greens stepped in. One scoop of powder in my drink or on my eggs in the morning, and boom, I was off and feeling better. And suddenly, I was losing weight. I was sleeping better. My metabolism went up. My blood sugar went down. My cholesterol went down, and my weight went down. And my doctor said, hey, whatever you're doing, keep it doing. You know what that is? It's Field of Greens. That's what I've been doing. Field of Greens is radically different. Each organic fruit and vegetable was medically chosen to support heart and vital organ health. I trust Field of Greens to keep me healthy. I promise you, you're going to love this product. But if for any reason you don't, they'll give you 100% money back guarantee. Now, you're going to get 15% off your first order, plus free rush shipping because of the incredible partnership we have here at Just the News with Brick House Nutrition, and of course, Field of Greens. All you got to do to take advantage of this offer, visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code JustNews. That's promo code JustNews at fieldofgreens.com. Don't wait. Go to fieldofgreens.com today. Use the promo code JustNews for 15% off. Hello, America, and welcome to a new edition of John Solomon Reports, the podcast from Just the News. Yep, it's the day after the Sussman verdict came down. You're right. Michael Sussman, the former Clinton campaign lawyer, acquitted by a jury after just 6 hours of deliberations. The jury concluded that he did not commit a federal felony by lying to the FBI. That doesn't mean that he didn't give inaccurate information to the FBI. It's pretty clear he did. He said he didn't do it on behalf of a client. In one case, he's at the FBI. Another case in the Congress, he said he did. His text messages seem to suggest that he told the FBI clearly he was giving this information not on behalf of any client. Yet his billing records show he billed most of the work for the research to the Clinton campaign. So people are saying, well, how can that be? How can that be? How can someone clearly give a false statement to the FBI and not pay a penalty? Especially when you saw what happened to Mike Flynn, right? That's what people will say. I have been saying for more than a week now, ever since the moment that the Durham team had to introduce evidence that the FBI itself lied about the same allegations. That's right. It lied to its own agents. The agents working the case were lied to by supervisors and told that this information, this evidence of an Alpha Bank secret computer connection that gave Donald Trump direct access to the Kremlin, something, by the way, that turned out to be totally bogus, that it came from the Justice Department. That wasn't true. You know where it came from? It came from a private attorney tied to Hillary Clinton and to a computer executive supporting Hillary Clinton. So we know at that moment that the jurors have to be thinking to themselves, well, if the FBI was lying about it and they aren't being charged, they aren't being punished, why should we convict this man? And I think that is probably the reason more than any other why the jury came back with an innocent verdict. And the reason I believe that, not only was instinct in watching it and watching the jury's reaction, but also seeing what the forewoman of the grand jury told reporters outside the courtroom afterwards. This is what she said. I don't think it should have been prosecuted, the jury forewoman said. There are bigger things that affect the nation than a possible lie to the FBI. She's even acknowledging it was possible there was a lie to the FBI. She just doesn't think it was worth her time. It wasn't worth bringing the case in federal court and tying up jurors' times. Now, that affirms what I believe all along, that the jury heard that and said, you know what? I don't buy it. This doesn't rise to a crime. Why are we having this? Particularly if the FBI was lying about it too. And wait, some of these FBI guys that came here are under investigation. What's going on here? So I think at the end of the day, this reminds us of something else that is really a truism in America. It wasn't this way when I first came to Washington in the 90s. I remember the outrage, the moral and legal outrage, about Bill Clinton lying to a deposition in the Paula Jones case. He eventually was impeached for that, over a lie. But over the last 30 years, Americans have become very cynical, and they see lying as a norm for Washington, for politicians. And that makes punishing a lie or a falsehood much, much harder. And I don't take my word that this is just my gut instinct. There was a remarkable Newsweek poll done in October 2020. By the way, just a few weeks before Donald Trump lost to Joe Biden in an election where a lie, the claim that Hunter Biden's laptop was Russian disinformation, not a true laptop, clearly impacted voters, right? That lie. But here's what that Newsweek poll showed. At least 54% of Americans agreed with the statement that lying has become acceptable in American politics. In other words, it's no big deal. So as you sit back and you look at this, sure, we're going to talk about the dual standards of justice again. I think that has been pretty well made. People will say, well, he did tell a falsehood. I think that jurors' comments speak volumes to the state of Americans' belief in their government and their political leaders. They believe more than likely they're liars, and they don't want to spend a lot of time punishing that. I guess they've come to accept the truth doesn't quite matter. And that is exactly what I think the verdict says about the Sessman trial. Now, we've got an incredible, incredible lineup for you today. Two all-star guests, both in the news right now. First up, Peter Navarro, the former Trump advisor. Yes, he's under subpoena from the Congressional January 6th Commission. He's defying that subpoena. He's under criminal investigation by the Justice Department for criminal contempt for defying that subpoena. And he's now sued the Congress, saying that the subpoena is not enforceable because the January 6th Commission isn't appropriately convened under the rules of Congress. So basically, the commission doesn't even comply with Congress's rules, therefore it can't enforce a subpoena. We're going to talk to him about that lawsuit and all that lies ahead. He'll be up first. Then we'll come back and have a great conversation with someone who is doing some really amazing work. His name is Paul Chesser, and he has done some great work on woke corporations. He has a project that he's doing on behalf of the National Legal and Policy Center, a nonprofit that does great investigative work in Washington. He has been confronting corporations about their liberal biased policies at their board meetings, at their investor meetings, filing complaints, ethics complaints. He's making a difference, using the process within the boardroom to try to get balance and to try to tell corporations, stick to your product, stick to making investments, stick to getting returns on investment for your investors, and stay out of politics. Paul Chesser is going to do some great work. He's the Corporate Integrity Project Leader for the National Legal Policy Center, and he's going to tell us a lot about what he's been doing at board meetings. A really fun story. That's what we got coming up for you. We're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, first up, Peter Navarro. Folks, if you owe back taxes, fair warning, you're not going to like this. The IRS is mailing millions of pay up letters. Millions, I say. Then it's up to the 20,000 new IRS enforcement agents to find you. Why the IRS targets you and not millionaires? Well, because millionaires have tax lawyers. You don't, you'll pay up. Plus interest and penalties. You need Tax Network USA, and you need them now. Tax Network USA has brilliant war room strategies to solve your IRS problems quickly and in your favor. Like a preferred direct line to the IRS, they know which agents to deal with and who to avoid. It's not all bad news for you because Tax Network USA learned of a special limited time IRS offer. They're willing to waive $1 billion in penalties if you qualify. So schedule your free confidential consultation to see if you qualify for this limited time IRS penalty canceling offer. To do so, call 1-800-245-6000. That's 1-800-245-6000 or visit tnusa.com/justnews. That's tnusa.com/justnews. Hey folks, as we approach another critical election, a wave of concern washes over America. Recent studies reveal that an astonishing 56% of our fellow citizens report feelings of anxiety or dread about the upcoming presidential election. That's why I stand with AMAC. AMAC is more than a senior discount organization. During these challenging times, they fight for common sense and hope that our nation returns to traditional American values. Visit amac.us/justnews today to seize an exclusive election year special, a four-year AMAC membership for just $30. That's right. You heard me right. 4 years for 30 bucks. As an AMAC member, you're not only enjoying money-saving benefits, but also the AMAC magazine, free Social Security and Medicare advice, a trusted voice in Washington, and a community of like-minded patriots who love this great nation. Take advantage of this election year special, 4 years for $30, and be part of the solution over the next 4 years. By becoming an AMAC member, you're strengthening a movement to dedicated to preserving the principles we hold dear in this great country. Join now at amac.us/justnews. That's amac.us/justnews. All right, folks, I'm so glad to have this next guest on the show, Peter Navarro. You see him every day on Real America's Voice on War Room, one of the most important advisors to President Trump during the Trump years, an expert on China, and now fighting back against the January 6th committee, which has subpoenaed him, referred him to the Justice Department. Peter, welcome to the show.
John, my friend, how are you? These are, as the Chinese curse says, interesting times for our republic.
That they are.
And yes, I am in the crosshairs of a Democrat-controlled mob that has weaponized the investigatory powers of Congress in a way which threatens, I think, a lot of what we hold dear in this republic. So you know, I'm standing up to them as they try to coerce me into doing things that I should not be compelled to do, and that's kind of where things stand.
Yeah, this is an important line of inquiry that you've made in your lawsuit. So let me see if I understand this correctly and then have you explain it. It appears that the argument is that this committee didn't follow Congress's rules for being a lawful committee, therefore it has no authority to enforce a subpoena. Do I have that right in layman's terms?
In layman's terms, that is correct. The legislative history of the what's called the Select Committee to Investigate the January 6th Attack on Capitol Hill. That's its formal title. I just call it the Kangaroo Committee.
Yes, you do. I've heard you call that before.
Originally, John, there was supposed to be a commission.
Right.
And there was a bill that was sponsored in both chambers. So this would be a bicameral, bipartisan commission to investigate January 6th. It was going to have five Democrats and five Republicans, so it was evenly split, Democrat chair, Republican vice chair.
Right.
And I think that's something that President Trump would have gladly cooperated with, because there are some real issues that folks on our side of the fence really want to get to the bottom of, such as did the FBI have informants that helped instigate the violence? There seems to be some evidence of that. Was the BLM and Antifa involved? Why did Nancy Pelosi leave the perimeter so unguarded? Why did the feckless Department of Defense Secretary, Mark Esper, have the National Guard at such a far distance that they couldn't really help? But this commission, this bipartisan, bicameral commission, was not authorized by Congress. It failed in a filibuster in the Senate. So what happened was Nancy Pelosi formed what she calls herself an unprecedented kangaroo committee. It's the kangaroos. Basically, you've got seven Democrats and two rhino Republicans in Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger. And it's an illegal, it's a committee issuing illegal and unenforceable subpoenas because it violates the rules both of the House to issue subpoenas and its own authorizing resolution, to wit, by House Resolution 8 in the last, for this Congress, you're supposed to have what's called a ranking minority member. That is to say, a ranking member from the Republican Party on the committee to consult with the chair, Democrat Benny Thompson, before you issue subpoenas. Kevin McCarthy, the minority leader of the House, the Republican, was supposed to be allowed to put on five members onto this committee in consultation with Pelosi. But she refused to seat any of the five, including the ranking member. Instead, without consultation, John, she just put Cheney and Kinzinger on. And so we're in this weird situation where this committee has no ranking member and therefore can't issue lawful subpoenas. And at the same time, it has the wrong number of members, 9 instead of 13. It's got a skewed partisan majority on it. And what, to me, one of the fascinating things was to kind of go over the legislative history of the committee members themselves. I mean, look, there's seven Democrats who, over the last more than 5 years since Donald Trump got elected in 2016, have tried to weaponize Congress's investigatory powers to remove Trump from office, right? That's they're in doing so, they violated the separation of powers because they're acting in a judicial function. But to just refresh everybody's memory, started with a now discredited Russia hoax from the very get-go in 2016, two discredited impeachment trials. There were three House resolutions to remove Trump from office on the basis of mental or physical grounds. And all of these things were perpetrated by the key members of the committee. Jamie Raskin, Adam Schiff kind of stand out, Benny Thompson, Luria, Aguilar, all Stephanie Murphy, all of these people, virulently anti-Trump. And you, what they're doing, John, rather than legitimately investigating January 6th as a means of pursuing a legislative function, they're basically trying to build a criminal case against Trump so that he can't run for president in 2024. I mean, that's the de facto mission now of this kangaroo committee. So I've challenged them on the grounds that they're not duly authorized or properly constituted. I've challenged them on a violation of the separation of powers, and by extension, accused them of violating the Bill of Attainder Clause. What is that? That is in the Constitution, which prohibits Congress from taking actions designed to punish people like myself. And it dates back to the days when the old English Parliament used to do that. And that's one of the reasons why America is America today and not a British colony. We don't put up with that nonsense. And then the most important thing about the case, John, which is so fascinating to me, is executive privilege and its companion testimonial immunity for senior White House advisors exists as a way of ensuring that presidents get candid information from advisors, right? And this goes, executive privilege goes all the way back to George Washington. Case law supports it. It's qualified after the Watergate era only in criminal cases. But right, these are two very important institutions for our republic. And when I refused to comply with the committee subpoena on the basis of executive privilege and testimonial immunity, the committee came up with this just absolutely dangerous and fanciful notion of having the incumbent president, Joe Biden, strip President Trump of his executive privilege so that I would no longer be covered by that, and strip me directly of testimonial immunity. You can't do that. There's no what they call settled law in support of that. You know, I'm an economist, but I have some training in the law based on my regulatory economics days.
Right.
And to me, you know, reading the case law, it's like this isn't an open and shut case. This is an open and shut case. What the committee is doing is what they say, ultra vires, unenforceable, and illegal. And so the subpoena they issued to me is unlawful. The House Resolution N37 they passed, directing the U.S. attorney to hold me in contempt is unlawful. And the latest thing is I get this grand jury subpoena from the U.S. attorney,
right,
basically demanding that I violate executive privilege and hand over some documents. It's like, so this is where we stand. And look, here's the thing. If they win this, it's going to be a pyrrhic victory, because if they win this, well, what it will mean is when the Republicans take back the House in 2022 and Trump's back in the White House in 2024, we're going to play the same damn game. I mean, they invite us to. We'll be subpoenaing them left and right, holding them in contempt. There'll be no protection of executive privilege. and it'll be, you know, a pox on their house because of what they did. I don't want that. That's not good for the republic. But that's what they're inviting in their kind of myopic quest to stop Trump.
Yeah. No, listen, it is about Trump, right? It's been going on since Russia collusion in the summer of 2016. Yeah. And it's the same process, right? It's law enforcement each time trying to settle a political score.
By the way, I would be remiss here, and I would appeal now to your listeners. The new book I have written, which is up on Amazon right now, it's called Taking Back Trump's America, Taking Back Trump's America on Amazon. And its subtitle is Why We Lost the White House and How We'll Win It Back. I mentioned this book in the context of this interview because this book is going to be so important to making damn sure that we are able to take back the House in 22 and take back the White House in 2024, so we don't have to put up with this weaponization by a Democrat Congress of Congress's investigatory powers. And by the way, I think if you ask kind of the average deplorable in the street, of which I associate myself closely with,
of course,
they are concerned right now about the cost of gasoline and baby formula.
Yep. Maybe a food shortage in the offing.
The economy and other things. And the last thing, literally last thing on their mind is the Democrats' little game they're playing on Capitol Hill in a Congress which has an approval rating, which is about the same as Joe Biden's. And it's far hard to get that low.
Yeah. Yeah, you ain't kidding. Also, the players on this are players that have not shown good faith in earlier investigations. Chairman Schiff is the sidekick to Chairman Thompson, gave us a lot of the false information that became a Russia collusion. Do you have any sense that if Congress got the information it wanted, that it would do a fair job, that it would do an honest accounting of what's in the documents or in your testimony?
Of course not. What they're trying to do is build a criminal case against Donald Trump, which on its face is a violation of the separation of powers. I mean, people, please understand, whoever's listening to this right now, okay? Congress does not have, no matter what you've seen with Watergate hearings or this, that, the other, whatever you've seen, like Congress does not have the power to investigate for criminal punitive purposes. That's the job of the judiciary.
Right.
It's the job of the Department of Justice. It's not the job of Congress. And one of the key aspects of my lawsuit is to force this issue to the Supreme Court. The controversy, as they say in legal terms, is whether Congress can pursue an illegitimate judicial function behind the mask of a facially valid legislative function.
Right.
Translation, John, it's like, can they act as judge, jury, and executioner while claiming that they're simply trying to get to the bottom of something so that they can pass new rules to fix it?
Yeah, so no, that's it. That's using their oversight, a possibility to build a dossier to send to the Justice Department, right?
Yes.
Now, your subpoena that you got from the Justice Department, what makes you think that the ultimate target is Donald Trump?
Because one of the things that was very unusual about the subpoena is they specifically mentioned communications between myself and the president.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked for the material, basically, that the committee had asked for in their documentations, but they went out of their way to mention President Trump's name. And that was both an assault on executive privilege, but also a tell that President Trump is a likely target of the committee's investigation. Look, this is collusion.
Yeah.
The Congress is colluding with the White House, is colluding with the Department of Justice, is colluding with the FBI. You know, memo to the FBI, you don't have to wake me up in the morning banging and kicking down my door to give me a subpoena. You know, just come a little later or give me a call. You don't, I mean, that kind of terrorism. Like, and by the way, folks, who are listening right now, they're not coming for me. They're coming for you. They will get to you. If they get away with this kind of stuff, they will get to you. That's what this is about.
Now, there's a very specific allegation. It's interesting to see that subpoenas don't normally make allegations. Normally, they just request information. But Benny Thompson's subpoenas are loaded with innuendo, if not outright accusations. Very weird to see that in a subpoena. It's backfired on him because he obviously made a false allegation about Bernie Kerik that had to apologize, say that was inaccurate, not true. But one of the allegations that are in the subpoena language, as I understand it from reading it, is that you were ultimately trying to change the outcome of the November 20 presidential election. Was that your motive when you were doing your research? Was your goal to change the outcome of the election?
My mission, and I talk about this in my book In Trump Time, within the context of what's called the Green Bay Packers sweep.
Yeah.
there is a law, an electoral act, dating back over 100 years, that provides for the counting of votes on a state-by-state basis where the votes are in dispute. As revealed by requests on the floor of the Congress. And all I was trying to do was to make sure that only legal votes were counted in the election. And we had over 100 congressmen who were on board with this plan, over 100. So I guess all those people are guilty, Benny, of whatever it is you think we were trying to do. But all we were trying to do is to make sure only legal votes were counted.
Yep.
That's it.
You weren't trying to overturn the election. You were trying to make sure that the processes were followed.
The legal votes counted. Let's see what happens after you count the legal votes.
Yeah. Now, I want to point out something because I've taken a great look at both of your books. I love Trump Time and Taking Back Trump's America. The introduction of your book says, "We lost the White House." Are you under some illusion that the election is still unsettled or something? Or are you willing to acknowledge that, hey, this is water under the bridge?
Illusion?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
No, I think the preponderance of evidence right now shows that the election was likely stolen.
Yep.
And one of the troubling aspects I see in the media all the time is these blanket statements.
Yeah, they're very sweeping.
As if it were fact. That statements to saying that the election was anything other than fair are lies.
Yeah.
You know, the big lie, whatever. And if you're a good journalist, the best you can say at this point is that the election remains disputed.
Yeah.
And in my judgment, the evidence I have seen across the six battleground states where the election was determined, is that this election was likely stolen and that we still urgently need to get to the bottom of this. And look, I mean, the committee, this kangaroo committee, starts off on a false note by asserting that the election was fair and any claims to the contrary are false. I mean, if you're making that claim at the outset, you've come to a premature conclusion, and therefore you've biased that kangaroo committee from the outset.
Sure. Yeah, no, I think that's right. Listen, there are courts that have concluded, like in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, that the actual tactics that were used for people to vote were unlawful, right? It was unlawful for people in Wisconsin, by the way, tens of thousands of them, to vote absentee at home, claiming they had a disability because they were afraid to go outside with COVID. Being fear of COVID is not a disability, the courts concluded. Pennsylvania said there was no basis for doing mail-in ballots to everyone without excuses, that the Constitution has to be changed. There are literally court rulings, but the media just gloss over these very significant court rulings that call into question the conduct of the election in two or three of the most important battleground states. It's remarkable how it gets glossed over in the media every day. How does this play out, Peter? We got about a couple minutes left. How does this play out for you? I mean, you've got the lawsuit. It'll work its way to the courts. You're intent on taking this all the way to the Supreme Court, correct?
Well, the worst case scenario is that they put me in prison for a year and fine me $100,000. That's the kind of terrorism and coercion that this committee and the Justice Department are engaged in. What I argue in my lawsuit is that it was improper for them to hold me in contempt to begin with,
right,
because they did not pursue what's called in case law the least burdensome alternatives. The most burdensome alternative, the most punitive, is to file a criminal contempt charge and prosecute me. According to one of the rulings in the Nixon case, they should pursue lesser burdensome alternatives. One would be to simply subpoena the records they're asking me to turn over. That would be the easiest way since they have that subpoena power. The second least burdensome alternative would be to file a civil suit rather than a criminal suit. And that was done in a case involving, I think it was Josh Bolton and Helen Myers back in the Bush administration. But they didn't do that. So the boss likes to say, let's see what happens.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Let me ask you a provocative question because it's at the heart of this whole thing. Did you ever see President Trump commit a crime in connection with January 6th? That's what they want to know, right? So let's get it out of the table.
Well, I guess what they want to know, but whatever interactions I have with the president,
yep,
one way or the other, is between me and the president.
Yeah.
I've always been consistent about that.
Right.
So, and no one should read anything into that answer.
Right. You're trying to preserve the privilege that every president is supposed to enjoy.
That's the kind of crap that gets pulled all the time. It's like, So, I think the point that it's applicable here is that leading into January 6th, there was a reasonable presumption that the election was racked by fraud and that there were enough illegal votes counted to sway that election, and so that it was important to try to look at the votes and sort that out, which is what Mike Pence was supposed to do before he stuck a knife in the back of the president in his little Shakespearean tragedy of playing, you know, his Et tu, Brute moment. And Pence, by the way, you know, as a historical character, he and his chief of staff, Mark Short, I mean, they will go down as the Judases of the White House, because both Pence and Short had an obligation prior to January 6th to share with the president and Pat Cipollone, White House legal counsel, the flawed legal opinion that Pence and Short and Greg Jacob, their attorney, had concocted that Pence would use to not move forward with the Green Bay Packers sweep,
yep,
which would have got us to counting the legal votes. So there's a lot of unanswered questions here. And for those of you who think presidential elections don't get stolen, let me just remind you of Nixon Kennedy. It took decades. But at this point, historians now generally agree that Kennedy stole it from Nixon, flat out. And that was a relatively simple steal involving ghost voters in Illinois,
right.
And some shenanigans in Texas. This is the most elaborate and sophisticated steal by the Democrats in our republic's history. But steal it they likely did, and I think we need to get to the bottom of that.
Yeah, the questions still aren't resolved. I think we have a lot more illumination about things that we know now are certain, right? We know for sure that illegal tactics were used in Wisconsin and in Pennsylvania, that they were unlawful, that there was no legal basis for them to allow the type of voting that occurred in those states. Those are significant things. In any other era of journalism, wouldn't those be the headlines right now?
To that point, John, when I was getting ready to file a lawsuit, which I did this last Tuesday, I sent out the suit with an embargo, a press embargo, last week, the week prior, to about 20 reporters on the grounds that they would respect the embargo. And there was only one newspaper that did what I consider to be kind of old style report the facts, just the facts, ma'am. And it was the Daily Mail. And they did a quite excellent, fair reporting of the events that were transpiring. Okay? That's journalism. Okay? Yeah. Opinions belong in the op-ed section.
Yep, that's
not
right.
Not in news articles. And to me, that said a lot about the state of American journalism.
Yeah. Now, listen, we've seen an enormous decline in it over the last 6-7 years. And the Sussman trial gave us some more examples of really bad reporting, didn't it?
Yep.
So, Peter, we're going to be watching this closely. This lawsuit is very important. It raises issues that other people have not yet raised. If Congress is going to issue a subpoena, it should at least abide by its own rules. I think that's one of the arguments a lot of common sense people would say. And the second is this question of executive privilege has to be decided, and that's probably going to end up at the Supreme Court. So a very important legal case that you've now brought before the American people. We're going to be tracking it here.
Thank you, John. And remember, folks out there, Taking Back Trump's America on Amazon.
On Amazon.
Help me help you and the Republic. Go order that today. And it's going to be an important part of the whole mission of taking back the House and the White House.
Yeah, the hardcover comes out, in September, right?
Yeah.
Very exciting,
folks.
You're
going to get it pre-ordered now.
Thanks. Get in line now. Be first. It's an important read, as all of Peter's work is. Peter, honored to have you on the show. Thank you so much for your time today.
All right, friend. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. Folks, we're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, an interesting conversation about the effort in woke corporations in America and one man's mission to get important issues in front of the investor committees, in front of the board of directors. A really fascinating interview coming up in just a few seconds, right after this commercial break.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
All right, folks, welcome back from the commercial break. So happy to welcome this next guest. He's doing such important work in the corporate space. Everyone's worried about woke corporations, values not being aligned, people in corporations focusing on politics, not on investment services and products, which is what a lot of people think corporations to stick to. Joining me right now, Paul Chesser, director of the Corporate Integrity Project at the National Legal and Policy Center. Paul, great to have you on board today.
Good to be with you, John.
You're doing some amazing work, and I want to really talk about the impact you're beginning to have in boardroom meetings, investor meetings. But before we do, I wonder if you could just spend a few seconds reintroducing people. They've heard of it before, seen it, but what the National Legal and Policy Center does, and specifically what your corporate integrity project within the group is doing.
Sure. Well, National Legal and Policy Center has been around for over 30 years now. It was founded in 1991. And they've been more probably more popular or well known regard to the their government integrity project.
And right.
They've exposed a lot of corruption and so forth, going back to the Keating Five scandal. They were a big part of getting the Senate Ethics Committee onto that. But we've got basically two arms: the Government Integrity Project, which has done a lot recently on the BLM and buying of the mansions with their donations and so forth. And Tom Anderson has done great work on that.
Sure.
My side of things is the Corporate Integrity Project. We've always done a little bit of this, going back to 2005. But our president, Peter Flaherty, he has to run a whole organization and he didn't have a lot of bandwidth to do it, but he would bring resolutions a few every year. But, recently, as we all see, there's a greater appetite for conservatives to get more involved in the corporate integrity side of things. So I was brought on, I've been with the organization part-time since, for about 12 years, but Peter decided to expand this effort and brought me on board full-time in October. And right away, there were a bunch of corporate deadlines to file resolutions for, and now we're in the heat of proxy season, as they call it, where we have to actually present our resolutions at these annual shareholder meetings. So that's what I've been lockdown doing for the last couple of months.
And you've been at some pretty important board meetings, right? Amazon, Twitter, Meta, among them. What has been the reaction to your presentations at those shareholder meetings?
Well, once you understand the process, you realize you don't get a response. First of all, these meetings are all now virtual because it's a legacy from what happened with COVID. They used to be in person. You used to go stand up on a platform and speak in a microphone, and the CEO and the board would have to sit there and watch you beat up on them in most cases. But now it's just kind of faceless and less personal. But we're no less aggressive in our attempt to hold these companies accountable. And the nature of these things, whether you're a liberal group, and it's mostly the liberals who've been dominating these shareholder meetings, bringing climate type initiatives and racial equity type initiatives and things like that, that's the left has basically controlled these shareholder meetings and as far as how many resolutions get brought forth. But whether it's them or conservative, the boards almost always oppose the resolutions. And then when you have these large institutional investors like BlackRock and Vanguard and State Street, who own the majority of the shares, and they're almost always in lockstep with the directors of the proposals, they get shot down, more than 98% of the time. But nonetheless, the left has been doing this and had great success at it for years and years and years. And even though the individual resolutions have been shot down over the years, they've made great progress in their efforts to get their agenda items addressed, to the point where we now see every corporation having an ESG or an environmental, social, and governance wing of their company for investor relations. That wasn't the case many years ago, and they feel the need to address limiting their carbon emissions and just addressing these concerns of these liberal groups. And that's how we've ended up with the boardrooms and the executive suites being so attentive and dominated by these liberal concerns. So conservatives have fallen way behind in this kind of activity. Everyone is seeing now, corporations are deeply influential in the whole political process. We could probably go into some examples of that. But now this year, conservatives are starting to show up. Us and our friends at the National Center for Public Policy Research are doing a lot of these resolutions this year. And, you know, half the battle is showing up. So that's what we're doing.
It's letting the letting the shareholders and the board members know that someone's paying attention and that there's a whole swath of America that has a different view than maybe the liberals who've been dominating the conversation at these shareholder meetings. I want to walk through a couple of things because there's all sorts of different lines of attack that you guys have taken, all of them designed to, these aren't bogus attacks. These are really designed to force good corporate behavior. And one of them starts with Twitter, right? You had Twitter. It hasn't done well financially as a company. It's really never succeeded big as it. And over the last year, it tripled its lobbying and advocacy lobbying while, you know, being underwater a lot of the time. I think it went from like 600,000 to 1.7 million in 2021. What message did you deliver to Twitter at that shareholder meeting?
Well, you know, a lot of these resolutions, they're very restricted by SEC rules and you know, what you kind of things you can bring up. So what we brought up with Twitter was a lobbying expenditure disclosure proposal. You know, it sounds very, you know, not very exciting, but, you know, these proposals, even though they don't sound very exciting, once you show up at the meeting, you can kind of broaden what you talk about. And so that's what we did with Twitter with our lobbying request. And you can't force a company to do something in its day-to-day business to change its activities or behavior, but you can ask for a report. So we asked for a report. Tell us how you're lobbying. How much are you lobbying? We wanted an itemization. We wanted to know amounts that they're paying, you know, for federal government lobbying, which is in public reports, but also, you know, at the state level, you know, state by state, how much do they lobby? What do they pay associations as far as, you know, industry-wide associations and what are those kinds of activities? So basically, we asked Twitter for that report. But really, the gist of what we were after was calling Twitter to account for its bias, for its censorship practices. We specifically called out their chief legal counsel, a woman named Vijaya Gadde, who's now become much more well-known than she probably ever wanted to be because she was reportedly in tears when it was reported that Elon Musk was buying the company and taking it private. So, but she's their chief legal counsel, and she signs all the lobbying reports to, you know, the Senate and House. So, in addition to her having that responsibility, she's also was acknowledged to be the chief censorship person behind, you know, the Hunter Biden story, the Hunter Biden laptop story,
right,
that Twitter censored from the New York Post. And the, you know, while they at the same time they allow you know, the story about this 50 former national security officials that called it Russian disinformation, that got wide circulation. So, you know, she was behind that. We called her out on it. You know, Twitter's actual lobbying goes, they're lobbying for things that are just a progressive laundry list. You know, immigration reform, voting access for minorities, policing reform, diversity and inclusion. And we argue that this should not be the purview of a company that's supposed to be for private company, making a profit, and those kind of things should be the purview of actress groups. So why are you spending $1.7 million in 2021 for these, you know, activist group issues? You know, that's what we addressed with Twitter.
Yeah, a very important argument. And a lot of the things that they were lobbying and really don't have an effect on the Twitter business model, right? They're society issues, but they're not really related to the core competency of the company or its core products. And I thought that argument really resonated when you had the opportunity to present it. A lot of the people we talked to today say, listen, and polling shows this too. People want companies to focus on their products, their services, and their return on investment to investors and stay out of politics. We don't go to companies for politics. We go to them for their products and services. And I think you've been very effective at delivering that message. I want to take you to another one that I think is really interesting, and that is Meta. Because again, there, like Twitter, there's been a lot of censorship, which is amazing because it's supposed to be a free speech platform. What message do you want the Meta shareholders to hear?
Meta, or formerly Facebook, our resolution there was similar to the lobbying report we sought. With Twitter, we sought a disclosure for Meta's charitable donations. So we wanted them to itemize and list who are they donating their shareholder resources to, what nonprofit organizations or what have you, what causes were they donating to? Because these companies, besides these big tech companies we're talking about today, we're involved. We've got had resolutions for charitable disclosure with Wells Fargo and a whole bunch of other corporations. None of them want to say who they're donating to. They'll be very broad and general.
Yeah, give large categories, right?
Categories, but they won't specify who they're giving to. They won't say if they gave to the BLM Global Network Foundation or what have you. So we want that itemization because, as a prospective customer or as a shareholder might want to know, it'd be nice to look up and say, hey, who have you donated to? Or if you're Wells Fargo, I live in the Charlotte area, you're donating to our local homeless shelter. Well, let me go find out, how much you gave to my local group. Why wouldn't you want people to be able to find that out pretty easily? So that's one of our arguments for these companies to disclose their charitable donations. For some reason, they don't want specificity. They just want to deliver the message they deliver. But, in the context of Meta, Mark Zuckerberg is, the chairman and CEO of Meta. And, he donated out of he and his wife's personal foundation, they donated more than $400 million through a couple of, radical leftist NGOs for Get Out the Vote operations in heavily Democratic districts in 2020. So, that kind of makes us wonder, okay, this is what Mark Zuckerberg and his wife did with their personal foundation. Did any corporate monies go towards things like that?
Sure.
It raises the question.
And transparency is one of the goals here, right? Just they're not exactly. Very transparent. Yeah.
Yeah. And I know that's, that's a big hot topic for you, John. But
absolutely.
Yeah. And so, with these corporations, you've got Mark Zuckerberg, who owns a majority of the voting shares for Meta. You've got with Alphabet, we may get to that later. You've got Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who own more than 50% of the shares of that company. They control, they can say, no, we're not going to do this. And it's like, what's the point of even having a shareholder vote? And I would say, okay, Mark Zuckerberg, if you want this total control or the guys at Alphabet, why don't you be like Elon Musk and take your companies private and do it the right way instead of pretending you're a public company yet not wanting to be transparent about your activities? So, that's what we address with Mark Zuckerberg because, in addition to, not being transparent about his charitable donations through Meta, they've got their censorship regime that they've implemented. And he's
particularly
got,
related to COVID.
Yeah, with COVID, with the Hunter Biden laptop story, they throttled back the sharing on that.
Climate change.
Climate change. He conspired with Dr. Fauci. That there's evidence of that he was talking directly to Dr. Fauci about censoring any information that he didn't support. So that's what we addressed with Meta and with Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, I think that's amazing. Let me take you to one more across multiple corporations. A lot of these corporations are believed to have given donations to the BLM Foundation. There's now a lot of concern about how that money has been converted. There are investigations such as the Indiana Attorney General. Getting a full accountability of how much money corporate America gave to BLM and how it's been spent, how important is that to your overall project?
Well, it's very important. We've cited it as examples in many of our resolutions. Now, a handful of companies that we are shareholders in did donate to the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation. And there's all kinds of permutations of BLM and local chapters and that kind of thing. But the one that's been a problem and the most highly recognized and got the most donations, upwards of, $60 to $90 million is the one run by Patrice Cullors. And she has shown that she's been totally unaccountable with those funds. They've had board members drop off, and it appears now she's the only one left to to be managing the funds. And as my organization, my counterpart with our government integrity project, Tom Anderson, helped dig up in conjunction with the New York Post, a lot of that money went to buying mansions in what rich white neighborhoods, which yeah. really does not align with her her stated Marxist outlook.
Yeah, sure.
So, you know, one example of a company, another big tech company that actually did give to BLM and actually had it in its matching program is Amazon. And Jeff Bezos, the former chair, well, he's the chairman, he's the former CEO of Amazon, right. said a couple of years ago after the riots following the death of George Floyd, he said, "Black Lives Matter speaks to racism and disproportionate risk that black people face in our law enforcement and justice system, and my stance won't change." He literally told somebody that on Instagram. Well, 2 years later, after it was all revealed that BLM, how BLM was unaccountable and pretty much corrupt with regard to the funds it received from a lot of these companies, they took him out of the Amazon Smile program, and BLM also got shut down in a couple of Western states because they weren't transparent about their reporting and everything. California and I believe the state of Washington prohibited them from raising funds in those states.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable, and it's hard to get a total sense of where the money comes from because it's so fragmented, the reporting, and that's why I think a lot of these shareholder requests that you're making are hopefully going to create the sort of transparency people get a more clear picture. All right, if you're going to give away money that otherwise could be returned to investors, let us know where it's going so we can make a judgment about that. I think that's really important. Now, people will say, all right, this is a lot of show. It doesn't have a lot of impact. It does, and I want to point to something I know you're very familiar with. Netflix has had a bad quarter or two. I think they lost over $400 million in revenues, 200,000 in subscribers in less than 100 days. And its CEO woke up and basically said, "Hey, employees, I don't care about your liberal views or your conservative views. Suck it up. Our job is to put on the best programming possible, not to have a social engineering experiment here." Your reaction to a CEO who seems to have gotten the message you're trying to deliver?
Well, you're right. Those are indications that are promising. I don't think Reed Hastings is any less of a principled liberal. I mean, his wife just gave a ton of money right. to keep Chase Bowden or whatever his name is in San Francisco right. as the DA, protect him from the recall. So I'm sure he and his wife are like-minded still there. But, you know, as far as running a business, maybe he's going to get blockbustered. I don't know. he's the one that slayed Blockbuster.
Yeah,
now,
of course.
Now Netflix is endangered. And the thing that I find interesting there is a lot of this, these corporations, bending the knee to the progressive agenda has been a lot, and especially the big tech companies, has been in response to employees. It's like they're afraid of their employees. And what's really, I think, redeeming about what Netflix did was they told their employees, if you don't like some of this programming, maybe Netflix isn't the place for you to work. Maybe you need to go work somewhere else. I have not seen that happen in a long time. That's more of what, who's running the show of these companies? You know, is it the shareholders? I was wondering if any of these CEOs and boards have any kind of backbone at all. And that's where Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, showed some backbone and stood up for Dave Chappelle and yeah. Ricky Gervais and their very controversial but impassioned and offensive to everybody.
Yeah, exactly. Equal opportunists.
Yeah. And that's where I would say our conservative side of things differs from how the liberals go about things. The liberal shareholder activists go in and they say, you need to adopt these liberal agenda items, climate change, racial diversity.
Our way or the highway, right?
Yeah. And us as conservatives, we just say, hey, just stay out of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're trying to serve the greatest number of customers and shareholders in the country. You want their business. Like right. Michael Jordan said, Republicans wear sneakers too, or buy sneakers
yeah.
too.
They buy food.
Just serve
they buy
the
movies.
Greatest number, and let all that other political stuff be sorted out in these other forums. And
so important.
Just do just conduct business the best way you can.
Paul, we just got about 30 seconds left. How do people follow the good work that you're doing at NLPC?
Thanks. We are at nlpc.org. And you get there, you'll see our homepage. You'll see our activism with regard to these corporations. We put a post up at every corporation we do a shareholder meeting.
Yeah.
Presentation at. We did Alphabet today and Walmart and Comcast. Today was a busy day.
How about that? Well, this is important stuff, and as busy it was, we really appreciate that you had made so much time for us. This is an important project you're working on, folks. Check it out, NLPC.org, and check out all the great work that Paul is doing. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, John.
All right, folks, we'll be right back after the commercial break to wrap things up for the day.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
All right, folks, that wraps up another edition of John Solomon Reports, a podcast from Just the News. Thanks for listening. Big thanks to Peter Navarro, Paul Chesser for enlightening us on two very important issues, wokeism in the corporate America sector, and of course, the dispute about whether the January 6th Commission is really legitimately formed to do its investigative work. There are important issues about January 6th. You all know I believe there's a lot of wrongdoing that was committed that day. But one of the issues is not being thoroughly investigated, and that is the police failings and maybe Nancy Pelosi and her leadership's failings in addressing the emerging evidence of a threat before January 6th. They didn't take the National Guard. Doesn't appear that they reacted appropriately to intelligence warnings from the FBI and other sectors. We've talked about that a lot with Kash Patel, two really great guests today to bring us up to speed on a very important matter. It does matter that a committee that is going to subpoena and refer people for prosecution, that it be properly convened. The rule of law matters in America. It'll be very interesting to see how Peter Navarro fares, whether the courts are willing to intervene in this dispute on this particular issue. All right, folks, that wraps it up. Another great opportunity to talk with some great people. So I want to thank you for tuning in. Lots of great things to talk about on a daily basis. And before we get started, I want to give you a quick heads up from our folks at Donors Trust. They are a sponsor, been around helping us before. They're back again at it. Donors Trust helps manage your charitable giving. Donors Trust was built with listeners like you and me in mind, people who believe limited government and constitutional rights are worth fighting for. If you already have a donor advised fund, consider opening a rollover account. It can be done in three simple steps by calling my friends at Donors Trust. The Donors Trust team will work with you to protect your charitable legacy and help you achieve your charitable goals. Partner with the fund that matches your values. To learn more, download their prospectus at donorstrust.org/justthenews. That's donorstrust.org/justthenews to align your giving with your values. Just visit www.donorstrust.org/justthenews. All right, folks, that wraps up. Have a great day. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of John Solomon Reports, a podcast from Just the News.
Hey there, it's Amanda Head, and I am thrilled to introduce to you my new exciting podcast, Furthermore with Amanda Head, broadcasting weekly from sunny Los Angeles, California, and brought to you by the dynamic Just the News Podcast Network. On this fresh and engaging podcast, I delve into the latest news with a little bit of a twist, exploring the furthermore of every story. But this isn't your typical run-of-the-mill news commentary or politically charged program. I interview a diverse range of guests, including business leaders, entertainers, musicians, educators, experts, politicians, and many influential figures from both the United States and around the world. So why not make your Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays a little more interesting? Tune in on your preferred podcast platform and discover Furthermore with Amanda Head on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. And don't forget to hit that follow or subscribe button and be sure to download the latest episodes. I can't wait to have you join me on this exciting journey.
At Just the News, we break the stories others in the media ignore or are too afraid to tell. We did it on Russia collusion, Hunter Biden, and the security and intelligence failures that preceded January 6th. Our stories have real impact and reach because we stick to the facts. I'm John Solomon. You can help me expand our honest, unvarnished, and unbiased reporting by becoming a premium member at Just the News. You'll get an ad-free experience and exclusive member-only access to events, and you'll be helping us dig up more truth. Join today at justthenews.com/subscribe.